Iran's president is urging Muslim nations to remain united and refrain from division. Addressing an international conference on Islamic unity in Tehran, Ebrahim Raisi stressed that Palestine is the most pressing issue of the Muslim world now. He also urged the Muslim community to stand up to terrorist groups such as Daesh. He insists that corruption, poverty, and terrorism should be eradicated from the Islamic world. Now, the president also encouraged closer scientific, cultural, and media cooperation among Muslim nations.
The 35th Islamic Unity Conference kicked off in Tehran with an eye for peace in a region that's gripped by unending crises. Over 500 Shia and Sunni clerics and thinkers from 39 countries took part in the week-long event to share their thoughts and viewpoints on the recent issues in the Muslim world. In his opening speech, Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi found the main source of problems in the Muslim world in division, the major profiteers of which, he said, are foreign actors in the region.
We seek to ensure stability in Islamic countries, unlike the enemy which tries to create instability. We believe unity is the strategy that the Islamic community should adopt, but the enemy's strategy is to sow discord.
This year's conference comes days after Daesh terrorists bombed two mosques in Afghanistan. More than 60 people were killed in the terrorist attack on a Shia mosque in Kandahar last Friday. The bomb assault came just a week after another terror attack killed more than 150 Shia Muslims during Friday prayers in the city of Kunduz. Both Shia and Sunni delegates at the Islamic Unity Conference denounced the carnage.
The Taliban government is responsible for protecting the lives of its people. If they want to continue to rule the country, they must stand with their nation and prevent such terrorist acts from happening again.
The main goal of terror attacks is to serve the Zionist regime, and that is to eradicate Islam and religion as a whole. They want to portray Islam as a religion of violence. They seek to pit Muslims against each other. So the major way out is that we Muslims sit and talk and have dialogue.
Participants at the conference say the terror attacks in Afghanistan were masterminded by the U.S. as an attempt to push the war-ravaged country into yet another crisis after Washington's humiliating retreat from Afghanistan.
America and American policies has failed in the region. Evidently, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and everywhere. And today they want to save their faces and still say that for security we are needed in the region. Hence, they are mobilizing their own elements like those extremists and Daesh and other elements in the region. And they are attacking in the mosque, they are attacking in Husseinias, they are attacking Sunnis, Shias, and they are again playing the same old game in order to embroil the region in the same sectarian and division and schism which we are suffering till today.
The annual conference is organized by the Iran-based World Forum for Proximity of Islamic Schools of Thought. The annual event marks the Islamic Unity Week, which coincides with the birth anniversary of Prophet Muhammad as an axis that unites Muslims, regardless of which denominations they come from.
Delegates at the Islamic Unity Conference say Daesh re-emergence in Afghanistan is a Western plot aimed at completing the U.S.'s failed mission in Afghanistan by sowing discord between Muslims. They say the ultimate way out of this regional crisis is for Muslims to stay united and let the Afghan nation take its fate into its own hands. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Allow me to introduce our guests in this edition. We have the director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bangash, in Tirana. We're also joined by head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajare, in London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the Spotlight, gentlemen. Let me start with Tirana. Mr. Bangash, unity and refraining from division is one of the highlights of the Iranian president's speech at the international combat underway here in Tehran. Let's talk about the significance of Muslim unity, and in special in this sensitive juncture.
Well, obviously, Muslim unity is essential if the Muslim world is to address the numerous challenges and problems that it faces, and in particular, for instance, the issue of Palestine. Now we face another challenge in Afghanistan. There has been ongoing war against Iraq and Syria and Lebanon and Yemen, etc.
Right.
And when we look at these challenges that the Muslim world faces, all of them have foreign interference involved in them. And foreigners are only able to instigate these problems and conflicts because they have managed to create divisions among Muslims. If Muslims were united, then obviously they would be able to face these challenges much more effectively. We can look at it another way. The divisions in the Muslim world are like a virus inside the Muslim Ummah's body. And when there's a virus inside a body, it is weakened, it is involved in fighting that internal virus, and the external environment, therefore, is able to attack the body much more forcefully.
Mm-hmm.
If the body were healthy, that means it were reunited, then any external threat would be less severe and Muslims would not face the challenges that they are facing. So
okay.
When we talk about Muslim unity, we obviously have to understand that it is essential in order to ward off the many, many challenges that the Muslims are facing. I also want to point out that Muslim unity does not mean Muslim uniformity. Unity means there should be a unity of purpose, the unity of interest.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when we look at all of these various challenges that the Muslim world faces, there is definitely unity of purpose and unity of interest. And towards these goals and objectives, Muslims need to unite. There have to be certain practical steps taken by the Muslim world. Now, when we talk about the Muslim world, I think we need to make a distinction between the Muslim masses and the Muslim governments. I think at the level of the Muslim masses, there is unity. This is manifested in the fact that, for instance, the Muslim masses worldwide express their sympathy and solidarity and support for the Palestinian people. The same applies to the Muslim masses' worldwide support for the people of Kashmir or the Rohingya refugees or the people of Yemen, etc. So we see that at the level of the Muslim masses, there is deep unity. Regrettably, the same cannot be said about the level of unity within the Muslim governments, because Muslim governments, or at least some Muslim governments, have different perspectives than others, and so this prevents for the kind of effective unity that we are talking about. But I think these challenges can be overcome if at least some Muslim governments are able to come together, mm-hmm. as we are witnessing today, as we saw in the defense of, for instance, Syria, as we saw in the defense of Iraq, as we saw in the defense of Yemen. I think there are some Muslim governments and movements that are prepared to stand up for Muslim unity. And the same applies to Palestine, which is close to everybody's heart, because Palestine is holy land, as well as the Masjid al-Aqsa, the first Qibla of the Muslims, is located. So these are very important steps that have been taken, and they have achieved notable results.
Okay.
Again, we need to be aware of the fact that there are imperialist powers that are constantly trying to create divisions among the Muslims so that it would weaken Muslim strength and dissipate their energies in their internal conflicts so that the imperialist powers can achieve their objectives.
Right.
But as I see the situation, definitely the Muslim world is on the ascendance. It is making great strides towards achieving unity. It is moving towards a direction whereby the Muslim world is able to ward off many of the challenges that have been thrown at them. We have witnessed this in Syria. We are witnessing it in Iraq, in Afghanistan, although Afghanistan remains a serious challenge, but at least the imperialist power and its allies have been driven out of Afghanistan, and that's a great achievement for the Muslims. So I think these need to be built on, and more efforts need to be made towards Muslim unity.
Okay, now let me turn to London. Mr. Shajar, go ahead with your comments.
Okay, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The fact is this, that Muslim unity is not an option. It actually a command of Allah. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Holy Quran says, At-tasamu bihamdillahi jami'an. Allah actually commands us to unite and hold on to rope of Allah. And then the following verse says, do you remember the time that you were disunited and I brought your hearts together? So the unity is not just a political unity, although it should manifest itself politically as well, but the unity is on the level of heart, on the level of feeling for your brother, feeling for your fellow Muslim. And actually then everything else kicks in that the honor of your brother, the need of your brother, the safety of your brother is your responsibility. And that sort of level of the unity which we saw in Medina between Ansar and Muhajirin and so forth, that sort of level of unity is a command of Allah, and we need to work towards that. There are many obstacles, and you know, since the Islamic Revolution, the West have been busy trying to find ways of disuniting us, forcing us out of having the vision of actually Muslim needs and aspiration in the world, against injustice, against bringing justice to everyone, including Muslims. And then also they are using these dictators who have been appointed by them, supported by them, and doing their bidding. Then we see the normalization with the Zionists abandoning our responsibility to Palestinians, and goes on and on, undermining the Muslim identity and indeed the manifestation of it. Islamophobia is another tool, stick, which is being used to destroy the Muslims' self-confidence.
Right.
If we come together with self-confidence and move forward, and this needs to be done on all levels, but it is absolutely essential that we will have a purpose to come together for the unity, not just a hollow sort of concept. It is the purpose of actually supporting each other at the most difficult time. And Muslims are facing, as Brother Zafar highlighted, Muslims are facing many difficulties.
Right.
Palestine, Kashmir, but let us not forget places like Nigeria, where huge number of Mu'mineen are standing up against injustice, and they're being hammered, and the tool of division is being used against them. And we need to challenge those, and we need to come together.
Right. Okay, Mr. Shajar, you know that Muslim nations and governments have very good reasons to unite and to work together. The issue of Palestine and what has been happening there by the Zionist regime since 1948 is one of these reasons. How can Muslims rally around the occupation of Palestine?
Well, occupation of Palestine is a sort of a point which actually highlights, not just in the region, but worldwide. It highlights the issue of justice and injustice. And and here the victims are Muslims. And, you know, it really is based basically one of the symbols of injustice and colonialism, which has destroying the region and beyond. And you know, the fact of the matter is that, as Zafar, Brother Zafar said, ordinary Muslims, and indeed ordinary people, are understanding this injustice. How we mobilize is actually we need to again go back to our responsibility towards each other and actually use every possibility we've got, financial and everything else, to use for liberation. But also we need to check on those who are creating havoc and supporting these injustice. We are seeing some of these dictators in the Persian Gulf are now becoming the champions of Zionists and promoting those injustices, and we need to speak out against them. And you know, I have to say, one of the other points that we normally forget is the rise of Islamophobia worldwide, which indeed we Muslims come together to address it. And it's really out of control now, be it in United States, Canada, Britain, and indeed even we are seeing the signs of Islamophobia in some so-called Muslim countries,
right,
where people are speaking out against implementation of Islam by Muslims.
Okay, that's right. Now, Mr. Bangash, Islamic awakening is another topic, you know, discussed recently in international Islamic forums. So what could be the fruits of Muslim nations' vigilance and awareness of the realities and developments unfolding around them in the world today?
Well, the first point is that we need to realize that who our enemies are, what are the forces that are creating these divisions among Muslims, and thereby, of course, stoking Islamophobia as well, because there are very large numbers of Muslims that reside in Europe as minorities, similarly in North America. And when we look around the world as to the countries that are being targeted by these imperialist and Zionist powers, then obviously they are targeting Muslim countries. Especially those Muslim countries that wish to break out of the stranglehold of these imperialist and Zionist and colonialist powers. And so they're targeting Muslims residing within their own societies as well. And that is what has given rise to Islamophobia. Mm-hmm. And it is a vicious, vicious campaign that has become more virulent over the years. More Muslims have been targeted and bullied. They are actually denied job opportunities, even though they are citizens of these countries. Yeah. Right here in Canada, where I live, the Muslims as a religious group have been targeted the most. In fact, the most number of Muslims or of any religious group that have been killed in their places of worship are Muslims. And Canada is supposed to be theoretically one of the better places in the Western world. So if that is the situation in Canada, we can imagine what the plight of Muslims would be in other places. We can take the example of France, where in fact Muslims are now not even given job opportunities. I mean, Islamophobia has become official policy of many of these states.
Right.
And so it is this kind of awareness that needs to be made and awakened among Muslims, that their very identity and survival is at stake.
Right.
And for this, of course, you know, you mentioned Islamic awakening. That, of course, is at the larger level. But I think the awareness of Islamic identity itself is essential. That Muslims must stand up and defend their Islamic identity, and not allow the Western powers and their demonic ideologies to distort the message of Islam. And we see, for instance, you know, there are all kinds of attacks on the noble personality of the Prophet of Islam. You know, there are caricatures of him, cartoons of him insulting the Prophet, when in fact no other religion is allowed to be insulted like that. No other personalities are allowed to be insulted like that. And yet they think that they have the right to do so when it comes to Islam and Islam's revered personalities.
Right.
So in this sense, Islamic awakening is an essential part of this struggle.
Okay. Now let me ask you, Mr. Shajwa, speaking about Islam, for maybe Daesh and other terrorist groups like that, they have also contributed to this. So, and we know that it has nothing to do with genuine Islam. So what can the Muslim community do to show that Daesh is just a project to tarnish the true face of Islam, which is a religion of peace? We have 1 minute.
Well, this is very obvious. It's very clear. It's very already exposed. Everyone knows that Daesh has got nothing to do with the Muslim community. Indeed, majority of victims of Daesh are Muslims, not non-Muslims, Daesh is killing more Muslims than anybody else. So this is actually a tool against Islam and Muslims. But one thing we need to be very clear that, there are criminals everywhere claiming to be whatever they are, and Daesh is no different to that. We are not answerable for those criminals. We should not fall into the position that we have to make excuses for Daesh because they are trying to associate Daesh with Muslims. One of the trick is to destroy the self-confidence of Muslims with Islamophobia, with use of Daesh, blaming the victims for the these atrocities which they have created and they are supporting. And I think the first aspect is we need to be confident. We need to be confident in ourselves, in our deen, in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Only then we could protect ourselves and people like Palestinians or Kashmiris and everything else. But the essential thing is that we have a confidence.
Okay, thank you very much. That's all the time we have. Let me thank our guests. We have Director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bangash in Toronto, and also Head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masood Chajra in London. I've been your host, Behrouz Nadefi, and I'll see you next time.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام من علم باب هدى فله مثل أجر من عمل به ولا ينقص أولئك من أجورهم شيئا.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, "He who teaches someone a matter of guidance receives the same reward as he who practices it, without any decrease in latter's reward thereof."
Well, Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Imam al-Baqir, alayhi salam, this divinely appointed imam, has very beautiful conversations and dialogues with his friends and his companions, his family and his relatives, and truly with the people in general. In these conversations, of course, he puts forth these beautiful pieces of advice and wisdom and knowledge unmatched by any other in the world. We find that in one of these instances, he talks about this concept about a certain people who are loved by Allah and who belong to Allah. In this conversation, Imam al-Baqir replies, "There are some blessed rich servants who belong to Allah. They are the ones who associate with the people, and the people live under their wing." Now, it's interesting, dear brothers and sisters, but for some reason, throughout the Islamic ages and throughout the history of Islam, we have found that the enemies of humanity and the enemies of Islam have tried their best to corrupt some of the tenets and some of the concepts within Islam, of course, in order to weaken the Muslims and to weaken Islam in general. One of these concepts is that Muslims should be poor. Muslims should be paupers. Muslims, therefore, should be weak. When Islam does not teach us this, Islam teaches us to be strong, to be powerful, to be independent economically, politically, financially, socially, culturally. We should be independent. And here Imam al-Baqir points to this fact. He says that there are some blessed rich servants, meaning people who have wealth. And these people who have wealth, they belong to Allah. And why do they belong to Allah? Because they associate with the people. They mingle with the people. They walk and they talk with the people. Because of their wealth, they don't consider themselves to be better, and they don't remain distant from the people. They are among the people, helping the people. And not only do they associate with the people and talk with the people, and they are with the people, but these rich servants who are blessed and belong to Allah and are loved by Allah, they keep the people under their wing. Meaning they support the people, they help the people, they help the people in any way that they can. The people feel safe with these individuals around them. They help the needy, they help the poor, they support the poor, they strengthen the weak. The people live under their wing. So, dear friends, it is good to have wealth, but only if you use that wealth on the path of Allah. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Baqir, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
Fortunately, some of the coins of those days of Abdul Malik bin Marwan, minted under the instructions and guidance of Imam of the Shias, have survived even now. In British Museum, actually, they have some of those. If you look at it, on the left side, you have the wordings in the middle, three lines. La ilaha illa, la ilaha illa Allah wahdahu la sharika la. This is the three lines. On the flip side of the coin, you have, you know, the second part of the surah, Qul huwa Allahu ahad. It starts with Qul is on the side. Allahu ahad, Allahu samad, lam yalid wa lam yulad. And the writing in this circular form there says Muhammadun Rasulullah arsaluhu bil huda wa din al haq. This is taking from the ayat of Quran that Allah has sent him with guidance and the true religion. Liyudhiruhu ala din kulli. So that he may give victory of to Islam over all the religions. So this guy was trying to do, you know, insult Rasulullah, and this is the ayat Imam is saying put there in this circular side of the coin. And on the margin of the legend, marginal legend of the coin, Imam instructed them that you should basically ask them to mint the name where the coin was minted and also the year it was minted. So wherever you do this, this will be the description of the coin, where it was made and which year it was made. And the most important thing is that Imam said that this is not sufficient only to mint these coins, silver and gold both. He says you should actually issue a declaration from the government that all these coins should be of same standard, weight-wise and value-wise, and make it compulsory for the people to use it for their trade and business. No other coins, foreign coins, should be allowed. And this is where, you know, basically this was the way that Imam dealt with the issue of the threat of the Eastern Roman Empire. And he introduced this concept of independence of the economy system in Islam, that Muslims should have their own coin and currency.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
With a few days to go to the fourth Mustafa Prize, the laureates of the Science and Technology Award are gearing up to nab the prize. The five winners were announced on October 12th in a press conference held in the headquarters of the Mustafa Science and Technology Foundation. They're now in Iran, visiting different scientific entities, including Iran's High Council for Cultural Revolution. They're here to talk about their scientific achievements and the significance of the international prize.
I'm extremely happy to be selected for this prestigious Mustafa Prize. It's a big honor and a great privilege to see that our collective effort with international collaboration Atlas, Antares, and KM3Net recognized with this prestigious prize. And I would thank a lot and all my gratitude to the Mustafa Foundation for this noble and for this exemplary manner they are doing their work to promote scientific excellence in the Muslim world.
First launched in 2015, the Mustafa Prize honors scientific breakthroughs in the Muslim world. It is awarded to Muslim scientists in four categories of information and communication science and technology, life and medical science and technology, nanoscience and nanotechnology, and all areas of science and technology. This year, out of 515 works submitted to the Iran-based secretariat, five nominees were selected as winners. Laureates will be granted cash prizes amounting to $1 million.
In the last four decades, we have been working in the field of natural parachemistry, and that has resulted in the discovery of many drugs.
That's why you are going to receive the award.
Yeah, I feel extremely honored to receive this very prestigious award. This award is already very well known globally because of its excellence, and the quality of assessment to select people is absolutely wonderful.
The scientific event is held biannually during the Islamic Unity Week, which celebrates the birthday of Prophet Muhammad. This year, the award ceremony falls on October 21st in Tehran, with the attendance of 50 scientists and scholars from 15 countries.
The Mustafa Prize says after four rounds, it has achieved its primary goal, to motivate Muslim scientists to compete for excellence. But the prize eyes for a bigger goal. It says it seeks to elevate science and technology in Muslim countries, to quote, revive the Islamic golden age in science. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Natal Vice speech, Hezbollah Secretary General accused the Lebanese Forces Party and its leader directly of conspiring to initiate a civil war.
I need to tell you very clearly, the real project for the Lebanese Forces Party is instigating a civil war, because a civil war will lead to demographic changes that would put the Christians in one area to create a Christian canton controlled by the Lebanese Forces Party. There would be no place for anyone else in this area. This is our understanding of our experience with the Lebanese Forces Party and the path it is taking. One example is that they were ready to give the service of starting a civil war on behalf of the former Saudi ambassador Sabhan.
The leader of the resistance said the Lebanese Forces Party is trying to incite Lebanese Christians against Hezbollah, presenting it as an enemy. Said Nasrallah gave a detailed explanation of last Thursday's events, stressing that the security apparatus gave Hezbollah a confirmation that the first bullets were fired by militiamen from the Lebanese forces against the unarmed protesters. This, he says, was all part of a plot to drag Hezbollah specifically to internal conflict orchestrated by foreign sides. Nasrallah said the U.S. is also trying to provoke an internal conflict in Lebanon the same way it did in many other nations. Yet Sayyid Nasrallah stressed the scheme will not succeed.
Hezbollah has 100,000 fighters. We did not prepare them to fight a civil war. We prepared them to defend Lebanon and our land and water and petrol and natural gas, which is being stolen under our watch. We prepared them to protect the Christian and Muslim towns in Baalbek al-Hermel. We were killed in Chaldea and we were silent. We were killed on Thursday and we were patient. It does not mean we are weak or incapable. We are thinking straight and we have ethics. I tell the Lebanese Forces Party and its leader, don't miscalculate. Be disciplined. Learn from your wars and learn from our wars.
He warned that in the event of a military conflict, neither Israel nor the U.S. or Saudi Arabia will come to the help of any warring side.
Sayyid Nasrallah was clear in proving that the Lebanese forces had always tried to target the resistance. But he was also clear in the fact that Hezbollah will not be lured into internal fighting and that the resistance is a protector of civil peace and unity of Lebanon. And those who are pushing for civil war are at the service of a U.S. project in Lebanon and the region.
Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said in his speech tonight that the main guarantor for peace and stability is the Lebanese state and the Lebanese army. Therefore, Hezbollah will put its trust in the judiciary to bring those who martyred people on Thursday to justice. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Despite the harsh living conditions caused by the years-long Saudi war and siege, thousands of Yemenis filled the streets of the capital Sana'a and 13 other cities to celebrate the Prophet Muhammad's birth anniversary.
Today, the Yemeni people mark this occasion and tell the world that we can overcome all challenges by trusting God. Despite suffering from brutal aggression, suffocating siege, and limitless conspiracies, Yemenis have managed to achieve victories.
Yemenis said they gathered to send a message to the world that Islam is the religion of peace and so it's a prophet. They called on other Muslim nations to mark this day to renew their loyalty to the Prophet Muhammad.
Islam is a religion of peace. Our nation will stick to its identity and values regardless of wars and aggressive policies. Problems have only strengthened us in the face of the enemies of Islam.
For centuries now, Yemenis used to mark the Prophet Muhammad's birth anniversary as part of their religious culture. Such ceremonies include various cultural and religious events, like reciting verses from Holy Quran.
Dressed in green, the color of peace and mercy, Yemenis celebrate the birth of the Prophet Muhammad, which is a great blessing for the whole of humanity. People, he say, Muslims around the world should follow the footsteps of the Prophet and stand against the enemies of Islam. Abdulatif Washali, Sana'a.
Thousands of Muslims gathered in the English town of Bolton on Sunday to celebrate a joyous occasion, the birthday of Islam's Holy Prophet Muhammad. The birthday of the Prophet, also known as Maulid al-Nabi, is commemorated in Rabi al-Awwal, the third month in the Islamic calendar.
These local Muslims are very excited about coming out to commemorate this day, as last year coronavirus restrictions prevented them from doing so. However, things are now returning to normal here in the UK, and these Muslims are coming out in strong numbers from across the country to commemorate the beloved birthday of Islam's Holy Prophet.
Apart from bringing Muslims together, it also provides a great opportunity to spread his legacy to non-Muslims too.
This is our message to everyone. All the humankind, you know, in this planet, that we should live each other, we love in harmony, and the teaching of our Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam is for all humankind. So this is why we are celebrating today.
In recent months, the beloved Prophet has been the target of insult in Europe, but these Muslims hope to break the many misconceptions.
It's been happening over a number of years. There's been very negative propaganda against Islam and particularly Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. But having said that, people with bit of common sense, they try to study Islam, try to learn seerah of Islam, and you'll be amazed, most of them become Muslim.
And when he studied different aspects of his life, his childhood, him as a husband, him as a father, him as a friend, him as a leader of his community, then you realize what a great person he is. And it'll get rid of a lot of the misconceptions and misunderstandings. And once you do some research and you speak to Muslims and you study his life, it'll enlighten you and, you know, you'll hold him in a very high regard.
In addition to prayers, Quran readings and the march, sweets and free ice cream were handed out, all in honour of the Prophet's generous nature. Robert Carter, Bolton.
Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat are asking the Nigerian court to enforce their fundamental right to movement by ordering the Nigerian Department of State Services to release their passports. The case filed by Zazaki's lawyers at the Federal High Court, Abuja, indicated that the secret police have placed a red flag and travel restrictions on the passports of Sheikh Zazaki and his wife.
We made several frantic efforts to get his passport back from them, so that now the trial having been concluded and they having been discharged and acquitted, we made requisitions to the states to avail them their passports so that they can, as free citizens, travel out. But the states turned down this request.
Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat need their passports to travel for urgent medical treatment abroad. Zazaki's lawyer said that placing restrictions on the passports of the Islamic cleric and his wife constitutes a threat to their lives. The case has just been filed and will only come up for hearing when it has been assigned to a judge.
To
but Zazaki's lawyers are optimistic that the hearing will commence soon.
Sheikh Zazaki is reported to have a dangerous and an unusual amount of lead and cadmium in his blood when he was shot by Nigerian security forces. His doctors have since advised that Zazaki be immediately hospitalized to remove the dangerous substances from his body. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
The olive harvest season has started in the occupied Palestinian territories, but instead of being a festive season, it's been overshadowed by the sporadic attacks by Israeli settlers like previous years. We visited the village of Al Mghayyar, northeast of the occupied Ramallah, where Israeli settlers vandalized over 100 olive trees a while ago. One of the landowners told us that settler attacks on the groves have escalated during the autumn harvesting season.
The settlers do whatever in their power to prevent us from harvesting. They till our crops, destroy our lands, and sometimes burn our trees. They try to keep us away from our lands. 2 days ago, over 100 olive trees were destroyed. The settlers are protected by Israeli forces.
As Palestinian farmers here and other villages suffer an almost daily act of aggression by Israeli settlers, a popular campaign called Faza has been launched to protect farmers. These areas are considered to be at high risk of settler attacks during the harvest season. Supported by the Committee Against the War Land Settlement, the campaign has attracted volunteers including university students, farming committees, local councils, and residents of the villages.
Every year, Palestinian farmers come under attack by the settlers in areas close to Israeli settlements. We have come to Al Mughayyar village to help Palestinian farmers in harvesting their products as quickly as possible and protect them against settler attacks.
Al Mughayyar is surrounded by a number of settlements. Israeli settlers attack Palestinian farmers on a daily basis, but when we appear in groups, our farmers feel safer and the settlers won't dare to attack them.
The vandalism by the extremist settlers have persisted year after year during the olive harvest season in recent years. Observers say these settlements have been set up to encircle Palestinian areas to make life harder for Palestinians. Olive harvest has never been easy for Palestinian families living close to Israeli settlements. Olive harvest is considered by many of them as a way to stay connected to their land and protect it against the Israelis. This land has been a source of food and income for Palestinian families for generations. Mona Qandil, Al Mughayyar village, northeast of occupied Ramallah.
From the 2019 anti-government protests in Lebanon to the 2020 explosion in Beirut port, the documentary delves into the heart of the historic incidents to shed light on the truth. Directed by Lebanese filmmaker Sahar Hossein Ghaddar, the feature documentary was premiered in Tehran. Over the course of the filmmaking, Sahar attended the 2019 nationwide protests, which she says were sparked by economic mismanagement and corruption, but were wrongly portrayed to be against the resistance movement.
The
2019 demonstrations were born out of people's pain and hardship and sought to put an end to 3 decades of corruption entrenched in the ruling system in Lebanon. People from all walks of life, including supporters of the resistance movement, were among the protesters. But Israeli opportunists tried to hijack the protest and say that the demonstrations were triggered by anti-Hezbollah sentiments.
The documentary also reviews the August 2020 blast at the port of Beirut, which killed 219 people. No one has yet been charged in the 14-month probe into the incident. However, Hezbollah has been critical of Judge Tariq Bitar for weeks, accusing him of singling out Hezbollah-affiliated politicians for questioning over the explosion. Last week, 6 pro-Hezbollah protesters were shot dead by anonymous gunmen during a demonstration by resistance groups who called the investigation politicized and demanded the removal of Judge Bitar.
Israeli footprints can be traced in the case that investigates the Beirut explosion. Israel and the U.S. seize any chance to deal a blow to our country and the resistance axis. What Mr. Bitar is doing serves the interest of our Israeli and American enemies by trying in vain to implicate Hezbollah in the Beirut port blast. And we saw a few days ago that our peaceful protests against Bitar were faced by sniper bullets shot by a Lebanese forces faction from a Christian neighborhood.
Last year's port blast happened after a fire detonated nearly 3,000 tons of ammonium nitrate, a combustible chemical widely used as agricultural fertilizer that had been stored unsafely in a port warehouse for almost 6 years. Based on information provided in the documentary, senior Lebanese officials were aware of the material's existence and the danger it posed, but failed to secure, remove, or destroy it.
The documentarian says her film tries to expose what she calls a string of lies that seeks to smear the resistance access. She says that string is pulled by Israel, stressing that she and her fellow Lebanese youth demand a strong government and judicial system that are independent of Israeli manipulation. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Anger boiling on the streets of Karachi. People have come together to denounce the recent deadly attacks on two Shia mosques in the neighboring Afghanistan, Kunduz and Kandahar, that took the lives of over 100 worshippers. Protesters are outraged at what they call the global powers' failure in Afghanistan that led to the chaos and instability there. They say those powers are responsible for the recent bloodshed in the war-torn Afghanistan. Protesters chant anti-Israel and anti-US slogans and stress the need for unity among Muslims.
We were martyred in mosques, we were martyred on roads and processions, but we never backed off from our stance of following the footsteps of Hussein ibn Ali. It is the responsibility of Kabul government to provide security to Shia Muslims in Afghanistan, otherwise Taliban government can never get away with global criticism.
Fear looms large that the government in Kabul is unable to curb terrorist groups like Daesh terrorist group, who has claimed the attacks.
We are here to show solidarity with our brothers and sisters whose loved one became the victims of brutal terror attacks in Kunduz and Kandahar Shia mosques in last two Friday prayers. U.S. shameful withdrawal from Afghanistan brought us to this day, where our brothers and sisters are not safe.
Protesters also called on the Pakistani government to take up issue with the Afghan government. They said the international community should not remain silent towards the crimes being committed against Shia people of Afghanistan. Muhammad Turi, Karachi.
Following fierce clashes with the Saudi-led coalition's forces and terrorist groups, Yemen's armed forces successfully liberated 3,200 square kilometers in Marib and Shabwa provinces, Bayhan, Ain and Usaylan directorates of Shabwa, as well as Abdiya and Harib of Marib were liberated during the operation named Spring of Victory.
Our armed forces have managed to accomplish a Spring of Victory operation in the Marib and Shabwa governorates and achieve their goals. By the operation, the army liberated vast areas amounting to thousands of square kilometers.
Yemeni officials say the recent victory was made in two strategic provinces with the cooperation of tribesmen in most of the liberated areas.
The significance of the operation lies in the importance of the two governorates in which the battle took place, namely Marib and Shabwa, which are oil-rich and strategic. This operation will have a direct impact on the Saudi-led coalition. The tribesmen played an unprecedented role in liberating these areas.
Earlier, the spokesman of the Yemeni army had announced that the armed forces liberated 600 square kilometers in the oil-rich province of Marib.
Vast areas in Marib and Shabwa provinces have been captured by the Yemeni army, which means that the armed forces will go further in their efforts to liberate the eastern Shabwa province after liberating the whole province of Marib, the last stronghold of the Saudi-backed forces in northern Yemen. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Kandahar mosque blast was the deadliest incident since the U.S. military withdrawal from Afghanistan in August. It was the second week in a row that a Shia mosque came under an attack claimed by Daesh terrorist group.
I
think Daesh attacks must be considered as crimes against humanity. They kill hundreds without being held accountable. The perpetrators are Takfiri terrorist groups and the enemies of Afghanistan and Islam. Taliban, as a new ruler, should maintain security, not only for their officials, but also for citizens.
Recent bomb attacks that targeted our innocent people have no place in Islam. They are misusing Islam's name. The government should take decisive measures and bring those responsible to justice.
Observers see the attacks as part of a larger plot to sow seditions between Muslim brothers in Afghanistan. They add that there are hands-off intelligence agencies and countries behind these divisive plots.
Being defeated in Iraq and Syria, the Daesh terrorist group is taking revenge on Afghan Shias. Also, the U.S. is seeking revenge for its defeat in Afghanistan.
Kandahar attacks comes in line of a series of attacks targeting the unity of Afghan Muslims. Moreover, the most important point about these attacks is that the U.S. is trying to create tensions in the region to involve Iran, India, and Russia in an unwanted war.
The Afghanistan Shia Clerics Council condemned the attack and urged the Taliban government to take action against Daesh and fulfill their promises. Shia clerics called for further unity and solidarity among all Muslims. The recent daily bomb blasts have caused a wave of shock among Afghans, especially in big cities. Many here say they now expect the Taliban to put an end to the terror attacks by Daesh and establish security in the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
I think I have to mention one of the qualities with respect to the personality of late Sayyid Jafar Murtada Amili, that he was truly considered among the scholars who dedicated his life to defend from the Shia.
So that's why we may say that Allama Sayyid Jafar Murtada Amili revised the Islamic history from the point of view of a Shia scholar. Allama Sayyid Jafar Murtada Amili is trying to criticize the history by compiling this book. I mean, As-Sahih and Sirat al-Nabi al-Adham.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Ya Mu'allim, peace be upon you, truly you are our teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is The Teacher. I am Atta, the host of this program. The Teacher is mainly concerned with the life and works of the most outstanding Shiite dignitaries, jurists, philosophers and thinkers all across the nation of Islam. And with me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyani. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So today we want to talk about an outstanding figure in the world of Islam. He was an expert in the field of history of Islam, especially the Shiite Islam. He was a Shiite biographer and a scholar of the Islamic Seminary of Qom and Najaf, whose main outstanding works were regarding the life of Prophet Muhammad and Ahlul Bayt. He is no one but Sayyid Jafar Murtada Al-Amili. It's about 2 years now that we miss this outstanding great Shia biographer and expert, and that's why we want to keep his memory alive through his life and education and his scholarly life. Sheikh Ziyaniya, let's start with you this program on Sayyid Jafar Murtada Al-Amili. So Al-Amili shows that he belongs to Jabal Amel, you know, in Lebanon, is it so?
Yes. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As you mentioned, respected late Allama Sayyid Jafar Murtada Al-Amili was born in Jabal Amel in Lebanon in 1945. He was with his father in Jabal Amel. He started his studying there. And when he was 18, he moved to Al-Najaf al-Ashraf in Iraq. He studied there for 8 years, and after that, it was near to the time of the revolution of Iran, not exactly at the time of the revolution, before the revolution, he came to Iran and started his studying in Qom.
That's right.
And he stayed for 25 years in Qom, and it's obvious that because he studied more in Qom, most of his, you know, important works were done by him in Qom, and he compiled and wrote these books in the city of Qom. So his activities were not only limited in Islamic Seminary of Qom, he was involved in the activities